The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Michael Nadoff, and I'm a proud library supporter and member of the Pepper Society. This evening's author event is made possible by the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. Through the support of private philanthropy, the Free Library Foundation enriches the library's essential services and quality programs. To learn about the foundation, please visit freelibrary.org/support. Tonight, I had the pleasure of introducing Shakespearean scholar and Harvard professor Stephen Greenblatt. Greenblatt is often hailed as the father of new historicism, as his works strive to understand literature within its historical and social context. He's written 9 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. In his most recent work, Swerve, How the World Becomes Modern, Greenblatt explores the rediscovery of the ancient Roman poem On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, and how this work fueled the Renaissance. On the Nature of Things contemplates the revolutionary ideas from the universe functioning without godly interference to how all matter, including humans, is made of atoms in eternal motion. Swerve illustrates how these dangerous, for their time, ideas inspired some of our greatest thinkers, artists, and writers. Unfortunately, some people still think these are dangerous ideas. The Library Journal praises Greenblatt and Swerve, calling it an outstandingly constructed assessment of the birth of philosophical modernity that deftly transports readers to the dawn of the Renaissance. Readers from across the humanities will find this an enthralling account, irresistible. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Greenblatt.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Michael Nadoff, for that wonderful introduction. I'm delighted to be here eager to tell you a little bit about what is, in fact, one of the truly great stories of discovery and momentous stories of discovery that's ever occurred. But having said that, I will immediately backpedal and try to explain that when the discovery that I'm going to tell you about took place, there were no symphony orchestras that were poised waiting to play the strains of Beethoven's Eroica. There were no drum beats. There were no announcements to the world. It was all very quiet and obscure. So part of the problem that, if it's a writerly problem, that in giving this account of what is, as I hope to show you, an astonishing thing that happened a very long time ago, 600 years ago, is to try to recover something of a world that we have now more or less completely lost, and to recover even the motivations of the people, the principal players in my story. The principal player in the account that I am giving is a bureaucrat, lifelong papal bureaucrat, was born in 1380, lived a good long life, died in 1459. In those days, that was a very long life, a man named Poggio Bracciolini. He didn't come from a famous family. You won't recognize the last name in the way that you would if it was a Borgia or a Medici. He was the son of a poor family from a small town near Arezzo in the area of Florentine power. His father was arrested for debt. At one point, he had to flee the little town. And even today, the town that he was born in, Terranuova, has been now renamed Terra Nuova Bracciolini in honor of its favorite son, but the truth of the matter is no one goes there. It must have been a very pretty town at one point. Someone told me recently that it was actually a beautiful town before the Second World War, but it was razed by the Germans after in retaliation for some partisan killing. It's part of the damage of the terrible damage, human and physical, of the Second World War. So even that, the medieval and Renaissance remainder of the town is gone. There's a statue of no distinction of Poggio Bracciolini in the center of town. I had my picture taken once standing under it. It's a place you would go if you were trying to get to the fashion warehouses, the Armani outlet, that in the not too far away on the other side of the highway. But you would know that you made a terrible mistake and turned left rather than right, or right rather than left, and you get off the highway and are in the wrong place. So what I want to do is the beginning. I'm not going to read from my book, I don't think, except a tiny bit now at the beginning, just to give you a feeling for what it's like as a book, what the writerly project is. The book, as I say, part of the problem is simply to get you to enable you to get something that's a little bit strange, which is what my fellow Poggio Bracciolini was doing in the first place 600 years ago, one January morning, when he was riding through southern Germany. I'll pick up in the middle of the story. Who was Poggio then? Why did he not proclaim his identity on his back, the way decent folks were accustomed to do? He wore no insignia and carried no bundles of merchandise. He had the self-assured air of someone accustomed to the society of the great, but he himself was evidently a figure of no great consequence. Everyone knew what such an important person looked like, for this was a society of retainers and armed guards and liveried servants. The stranger, simply attired, rode in the company of a single companion. When they paused at inns, the companion, who appeared to be an assistant or servant, did the ordering. When the master spoke, it became clear that he knew little or no German and that his native language was Italian. If he had tried to explain to an inquisitive person what he was up to, the mystery of his identity would only have deepened. In a culture with very limited literacy, to be interested in books was already an oddity. And how could Poggio have accounted for the still odder nature of his particular interests? He was not in search of books of hours or missals or hymnals whose exquisite illuminations and splendid bindings made manifest their value even to the illiterate. These books, some of them jewel-encrusted and edged with gold, were often locked in special boxes or chained to lecterns and shelves so that light-fingered readers could not make off with them. But they held no special appeal for Poggio, nor was he drawn to the theological, medical, or legal tomes that were the prestigious tools of the professional elites. Such books had a power to impress and intimidate even those who could not read them. They still do. They had a social magic of the kind associated for the most part with unpleasant events, a lawsuit, a painful swelling in the groin, an accusation of witchcraft or heresy. An ordinary person would have grasped that volumes of this kind had teeth and claws, and hence have understood why a clever person might hunt them. But here again, Poggio's indifference was baffling. The stranger was going to a monastery, but he was not a priest or a theologian or an inquisitor, and he was not looking for prayer books. He was after old manuscripts, many of them moldy, worm-eaten, and all but indecipherable even to the best-trained readers. If the sheets of parchment on which such books were written were still intact, they had a certain cash value, since they could be carefully scraped clean with knives, smoothed with talcum powder, and written over anew. But Poggio was not in the parchment-buying business, and he actually loathed those who scratched off the old letters. He wanted to see what was written on them, even if the writing was crabbed and difficult, and he was most interested in manuscripts that were 400 or 500 years old, going back then to the 10th century or even earlier. To all but a handful of people in Germany, this quest had Poggio tried to articulate it, would have seemed weird. And it would have seemed weirder still if Poggio had gone on to explain that he was not, in fact, at all interested in what was written 400 or 500 years ago. He despised that time and regarded it as a sink of superstition and ignorance. What he really hoped to find were words that had nothing to do with the moment in which they were written down on the old parchment, words that were, in the best possible case, uncontaminated by the mental universe of the lowly scribe who copied them. That scribe, Poggio hoped, was dutifully and accurately copying a still older parchment, one made by yet another scribe, whose humble life was equally of no particular consequence to the book hunter, except insofar as it left behind this trace. If the nearly miraculous run of good fortune held, the earlier manuscript, long vanished into dust, was in turn a faithful copy of a more ancient manuscript, and that manuscript a copy of yet another. Now, at last, for Poggio, the quarry became exciting, and the hunter's heart in his breast beat faster. The trail was leading him back to Rome, not the contemporary Rome of the corrupt papal court, intrigues, political debility, and periodic outbreaks of bubonic plague, but the Rome of the Forum and the Senate House, and a Latin language whose crystalline beauty filled him with wonder and the longing for a lost world. All right, that's an attempt to conjure up this peculiar thing that my hero was, a book hunter who wanted to find things, but what he wanted to find were things that were copies of things, that were copies of things, that were copied of things, leading way, way back to a distant past. One day, as I say, in the winter of 1417, he found himself ferreting through a monastic library in Germany, and he found one of the things that he was looking for. In fact, he had had a marvelous day that day in January 1417. First, he had found an interesting manuscript by an early Christian father in whom he was interested, Lactantius, the author of The Wrath of God. Lactantius was a writer who argued that God's anger was a sign of his love, that the only way we knew God loved us was that he was angry with us, and that, like a good father, he punished and punished and punished, and that was the surest mark of divine love. Then he found an old Roman history that he had never heard of before. It wasn't complete. It was about the late Roman history of the wars against the barbarians, but it excited him and interested him. He found a manuscript that had a list of grammatical rules in Latin that was very interesting to him because he and his friends were had a almost frenzied interest in the details of Latin grammar. And then he found the manuscript in which I am profoundly interested and about which my book is written. The manuscript he found was probably about 500 years old. That is to say, it had been copied in the 9th or possibly the 10th century. But Poggio realized immediately, I think, that the words on the page were much older still. I think, though we don't have a record of this, I think that he recognized the name of the author of the poem and possibly the name of the poem itself. He saw that it was a poem, a very long poem, 7,400 lines. He saw that it was a poem that neither he nor anyone in his world had read, but he might have recognized the name. The name of the poet was Titus Lucretius Carus. Lucretius is the way we usually refer to him. He was a writer who lived at the time of Cicero and Julius Caesar. And he was, in a reasonable way, a well-known writer from his time, but that and had written the poem probably around 50 before the Christian era. The poem that he had written was called On the Nature of Things, De Rerum Natura. on the nature of things, the way things are. It had once, at least among the educated elite of Rome, caused a considerable stir. The poet Virgil had been powerfully affected by it. It refers to it indirectly but manifestly in his poem The Georgics, and even more grapples with it mightily in his great epic The Aeneid. Ovid, the poet Ovid, said that the verses of Lucretius would last until the last day of the world. Well, Ovid was wrong. Well, maybe we haven't reached the last day of the world, but he was almost wrong. He was almost wrong because this poem, which was, as I say, well known in its time, referred to by Cicero, referred to by a Roman emperor who said, bring me something by Lucretius to read, and so forth. We have a little a record of that letter. This poem had vanished from sight sometime around the 4th century. So my book is about a finding, but it's also about a vanishing. Why does something vanish, something important like this vanish? Why does it disappear? Cultures don't always move in the same direction. We think that everything is going to be preserved. We think everything is going to, everything important at least, is going to survive. But it's not true. It's no more true than that we survive. Things disappear. And in the ancient Roman world, there was a glut of books. For a long period of time, people worried about where are we going to put the books? How are we going to organize them on our shelves? And there were extremely clever people who invented things like alphabetical order to try to figure out how to organize the sheer number of scrolls on the shelves of their libraries. And there were astonishing libraries like the great library at Alexandria in Egypt that tried to collect everything, to have the whole sum of human learning in a single library. But they didn't last. They didn't survive. Why? A whole set of reasons. The most obvious reasons having to do with war, fire, plunder, bloodshed that descended on the Roman world, first in smaller waves and then in larger and larger waves. And suddenly the problem began to shift, where people had been worried about what are we going to do? How are we going to survive under the sheer flood of books? They stopped worrying about books completely. The books in the ancient world survived, as I said, by being copied. They still survive only by being copied. We have other ways of speaking about copying books now digitally and before then through print. But before the digital media and before print, everything that survived, survived by someone sitting down and copying it by hand. And the Romans, the Greeks before them, had teams of people, mostly slaves, who did the work of copying. And unlike our digital media, which lasts approximately 6 weeks before the medium changes, and we can no longer read things, these things tended to last a long time. I used to keep a record of my dreams in a kind of self-interested way. I would type my dreams out, and I typed them on my K-Pro on something called CPM. And now I suppose if I go to NASA, they'd be able to decipher my dreams. But otherwise, those diskettes are completely useless. In those days, they lasted longer. The papyruses that people used to write on, or the parchments that people used to write on, they could be around for in a good climate for hundreds of years, if you kept them out of the rain, kept them from being moldy, and did certain things to protect them, like put them in cedar boxes so that the worms wouldn't eat them too quickly. But eventually, those books, like our books, fall apart, and they had to be copied. And as they say, they had an elaborate world of copying. But when the barbarians are at the gates, when your walls are crumbling, when your economy is failing you, when you have a series of rabble-rousing leaders, none of whom like each other, all of whom are squabbling, and who are leading you down the road to chaos and disruption, you don't have time to copy books. You lose the interest in copying books. You don't put money into the culture of books any longer. So gradually, starting around the 4th century, the public libraries, which had been opened. Rome had lots of public libraries from the time of Julius Caesar on, as well as many, many private libraries, and an elaborate educational system. They began to shut it all down. The libraries were locked and shuttered with the thought that someday they might reopen them, but they didn't reopen. The educational system closed down. The teams of people who were hired by individual readers or by consortia to copy books stopped getting employed, and the culture began to vanish. There was a great vanishing of ancient books, so that of the 70 or 80 plays, let's say, that were known to have been authored by Sophocles, comparable number by Aeschylus, 7 survive for each of them, slightly larger number for Euripides, but not much larger. And that's only, and those were the big success stories, the great triumphs, because Sophocles and Aeschylus and Euripides won the huge prizes in Athens. And comparably, a few things, the Aeneid, the works of Virgil, of course, some of them at least survived, and the works of Ovid, some of them at least survived. But hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books disappeared in this great vanishing, including some of the books that were most important to the ancient world. If you actually look, and I quote some of them in the book, if you look at lists of books that ancients thought were tremendously important, you realize that almost none of them survive. Just a handful of ones whose names we recognize. So that was a general vanishing. But then, for reasons I will explain to you, there was a particular vanishing that hit the book and the whole world of the book that the book hunter Poggio Bracciolini managed somewhat miraculously to find. Poggio Bracciolini was a very, very good trained scribe. He made his name in the world in the way that only characters in Gilbert and Sullivan do, by having fantastically good handwriting. So that's how he came to the attention of the Chancellor of Florence. He arrived in Florence when he was in his teens, Poggio, in the 1390s, with, he says, 5 pennies in his pocket. He had nothing, no family behind him. But he had this gift that had already begun to develop of wonderful handwriting, and it actually is a miracle. If you look, there's a picture of two in my book, if you look at the handwriting, it's actually very beautiful. And it's familiar as well, because it's the handwriting on which our most beautiful typefaces are based, including italics. He invented, in effect, the way of writing that we still regard as the clearest and most beautiful ever written. That's not a bad thing to have done. So just as a graphic designer, the guy was a genius. But it wasn't a job of graphic designer in those days. He was a notary, a scribe, and he came to the attention of a fascinating man who was a politician, the chancellor, equivalent of the ruler of the prime minister, let's say, or foreign secretary of Florence, a man named Coluccio Salutati, who was then already a rather elderly man. And Salutati took Poggio and other young men under his wing and helped to train them, to perfect their Latin, to teach them some Greek, to imbue them in the culture of both the present world and then the Florentine patriotism that he passionately felt. And for Salutati, something related to the Florentine patriotism, the dream that there was once a better world. Italians then, as Italians now, are surrounded by the astonishing architectural traces of the past. There were more architectural traces then than there are now, because what was going on all during Poggio's lifetime, before and afterwards, for a very long time, was people ripping down those buildings in order to build their houses, their pigsties, or their churches. But there were lots of these traces. And you could look around and see that there was once a time in which something astonishing existed in Italy. For a long period of time, people didn't look around in that spirit. They simply built their pigsties. But at a certain point in the 14th century, under the influence of that remarkable poet and scholar, Francesco Petrarca, people began to have a different relationship to the Petrarch. People had a different relationship to the past. They began to think about that ancient past with longing. And Poggio, the very poor boy on the make in Florence, got that bug for finding traces of the ancient world. But he wasn't actually a particular Florentine patriot, and he wasn't willing to spend his life as a schoolteacher or a scholar. He wanted the prize, the job of jobs that an ambitious young man of his age wanted, the job. At a certain point, we can all recite to ourselves before various financial crashes, what was the job that people really wanted, the Drexel Burnham job, the McKenzie job, or whatever. He wanted the job in the Vatican. And he got Salutati to write him a letter of recommendation. He went to Rome, and he managed, after a bit, to secure one of the prized jobs of, they called them apostolic scriptors in the papal court. You copied documents in the papal court. Doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me. But it was actually a very good job because you could make a lot of money at it. Because people would pay you to copy documents to present to the Pope or to the Pope's intimates in order to receive one favor or another of various kinds that the Vatican had to hand out. And eventually, actually, he not only was this papal scriptor as he was for some years, but he became something even more important. He became, shortly before the story that I'm writing about in my book, he became the apostolic secretary, it was called. And secretary has our meaning of secretary, but it also has the force of secret in it, the keeper of the secrets, the person in the intimate circle of an extremely powerful, quite remarkable pope who happens to have been, and as you may know, this is actually saying something, probably the worst pope in the history of the papacy. This was a man named Bartolomeo Cossa, who came from a family, a southern Italian family that was most famous for piracy. And they continued, actually, to be pirates at a quite successful level. And he himself, even after he moved in a different sphere, had something of the family business in him all his life. So he was also extremely learned, extremely cunning, very wily. People, important people, had dinner with him and then didn't survive till the next day, kind of thing. He, including the person whom he succeeded as Pope, who made the mistake of visiting him in Bologna, where he was cardinal. And Poggio became the apostolic secretary to this remarkable man, Bartolomeo Cossa, who was then ruling as Pope John the 23rd. That's what he called himself. Now, I don't know about you, if anyone in this room, Catholic or not, if that rings a bell, John the 23rd. John the 23rd actually was a, I'm not Catholic, but John the 23rd was a hero of mine. He's a fantastic, but not this John the 23rd. What had happened was, for reasons I'll explain to you, that name became available, but it became toxic as well as available. So it languished from 1415, when it was taken away, as I'll explain in a minute, until 1958. That's how long the toxicity lasted, when the remarkable, also Southern Italian, but saintly, Angelo Roncalli decided to take the name John the 23rd and became the Pope of Vatican II. I mean, there's controversies about him, of course, but a remarkable and wonderful, I think, man who had the daring to take a name. No, there were no Johns between in the papacy between 1415 and 1958. And that was because in the early years of the 16th century, of the 15th century, the noose began to tighten for various reasons that I won't go into, though they're delicious, around Poggio's boss, John the 23rd. And he was forced very much against his will, to call a council of cardinals in the city of Constance. Some of you may have been to a beautiful city in southern Germany on the what the Germans call the Bodensee, the Lake of Constance. There was an extraordinary event in Constance. He thought, clever fellow that he was, that he could distract people's attention in the usual way by combination of corruption, bribery, and so forth, but also by turning the attention of the cardinals to the fight against heresy. And he lured the Bohemian heretic Jan Hus and Hus's associate Jerome of Prague, under promises of safe conduct and so forth and so on, to Constance. And then he participated in the trial and execution of these heretics. But as soon as they get finished with that bit of business, the cardinals turned on John the 23rd, and they had him thrown in a dungeon. In fact, the same dungeon that Jan Hus had been thrown into. At that point, the Pope was not allowed to see any of his secretaries or assistants. He went into an elaborate plea bargain, as we would say, and he agreed to admit, to cop to an extraordinary list of terrible charges against him, including murder and simony, incest, and so forth, in exchange for the dropping and suppression of the 16 worst charges against him, which had never been found. But actually, the ones he confessed to are so ghastly that it's hard to think of what was in those other charges. Cannibalism is the best I can think of. I can't imagine what else there was. In any case, our guy, Poggio, was out of work. He had nothing to do. And other apostolic secretaries scrambled, because there was a team of them, to find something else to do. But he did something else. He had that thing in him, that book hunting thing in him, and he went book hunting. And it was then and at that point that he found in a monastery in probably somewhere in Germany, it could have been Switzerland, but more likely in Germany, and I think it was the monastery of Fulda for reasons I could explain, but it might not have been, he found this remarkable book. So why is the book so remarkable, as I've waited until now to tell you? Why is it important that he found this? Because this is what Lucretius was about. Some pagan texts, philosophical texts, had survived, at least in pieces, throughout the Middle Ages. So some of Plato had survived, the work called the Timaeus, and then more came back. Some of Aristotle, quite a bit of Aristotle, had survived in the Middle Ages. So there were certain things that had continuity. And the Christian world could come to terms with that inheritance and take what it wanted from that inheritance, adapt it for its own interests. Obviously, Aristotle was no Christian. Plato was no Christian. But they could use lots of things from Plato and Aristotle to form their own intellectual world. But there was a particular school of ancient philosophy that, in what I've called the Great Vanishing, vanished almost completely. And that was the world of what was called ancient materialism, the world that had come from the Greeks, from Leucippus, from Democritus, and above all from the philosopher Epicurus, who lived in the generation just after Plato. And they're all gone. A couple of very short works of Epicurus survive because they're quoted intact in a history of philosophy that was written by someone in the ancient world. But everything else, all the works of other works of Epicurus, all the works of Democritus, all the works of Leucippus, all gone. Everything was riding on this one, as it happened, one work, a poem of all things, by a great disciple of Epicurus, the man Lucretius. So what does it argue? What came back in 1417? Here's what came back. The world, Lucretius said, was made up out of untold numbers, an infinite number of infinitesimally small, invisible, indestructible, he called them the seeds of things, indestructible particles, which the Greeks called atoms. And there were atoms, and there was emptiness, or void, as they called it, and nothing else. No other mysterious forces, no further terms, no demons or angels moving things about. Those atoms, Lucretius thought, were in constant motion. His example, his idea of them, he says, look in a beam of sunlight. Do you see that there are thousands of things in that beam of sunlight that you don't ordinarily see, but that are dancing around very rapidly? Well, those are much bigger, obviously, than the atoms. Those are just dust motes. But they're like what the whole world must be made up of, what you're made up of, what I'm made up of, what this desk is made up of. Things that look stable and solid are made of infinitesimally small things that are in motion, and they're eternal. The form is not eternal. This desk is not eternal. I, alas, am not eternal. But the stuff I'm made of is eternal. It'll become something else after me. The universe, Lucretius said, didn't need a creator or a designer. It didn't need intelligent design. It doesn't have providence behind it. It wasn't created by anybody. It was the product of an infinite period of time in which atoms crashed into each other, came apart, crashed, came apart, formed things which might have survived, might even have reproduced. Because he said, if by accident something emerged from one of these atomic conjunctions, one of these mutations, as we would say, that could reproduce, could figure out how to get food for itself, could figure out how to ward off enemies and could reproduce, it might survive as a species for some period of time. And there probably were such creatures of a different kind before we lived on the earth. And there will be creatures of a different kind after we cease as a species to live in the world. That must have happened because of the, by implication, thinking through the implications of the idea of atoms. Everything comes into being because of random mutations, because of what Lucretius, in a crucial term, called a tiny swerve of the atoms. If the atoms didn't swerve, they would just fall down straight and wouldn't interact with each other. But the atoms don't fall down straight because actually they're moving. You can't, as quantum physics now says, they are never in a stable place. There's always some tiny quantum of movement in them, and that's enough to make them start banging into each other and forming things. Nature ceaselessly experiments. The universe was obviously not created for humans. If you just look around in the world, a world full of wild beasts and disease, I don't know if he knew about the prostate, but a world that obviously wasn't purpose-built for our benefit, but that emerged through a series of random accidents, he thought. Humans are thrown in, as he calls, onto the shores of light, weeping because they're completely unprotected at the beginning. They need to be sheltered and fed by their parents. And humans are not unique in their feelings. Animals have feelings. Animals have senses and intelligences of their own. And humans cannot expect anything after this life. The soul is made up, he thought, of atoms, just as the body is made up out of atoms. When our body disintegrates, our soul will disintegrate as well. That was, he thought, the good news. It was the good news because we don't have to worry about pushing a rock up a hill for eternity afterwards, or about being tantalized by water somewhere. We're not going to get rewarded. We're not going to get punished. It's whatever we can make of this life and here and now. And in this life here and now, it won't help, he wrote, to hope or fear the gods, to try to appease them, to try to placate them, or to try to flatter them. Because the gods, and he thought gods existed, the gods aren't interested. The gods have actually no interest in anything outside their own internal pleasure. And that's because the gods are models for whatever Lucretius and the whole Epicurean tradition thought was the highest good of existence, and that was pleasure. Humans are no different from any other animal. We approach pleasure and we try to avoid pain. And the meaning of existence, whatever ethical meaning, moral meaning, political meaning we can come up with in the world, will have to begin and end, he thought, in the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. he didn't find this depressing news. He found this happy news and a source of wonder. Now, I'm going to bring these remarks to a close, and I can answer questions about them. But the general question I would put out for you is the list of propositions that I've just given you was not, as you can imagine, received as good news or the truth in 1417. And in fact, as you will have perceived, it's not a platform on which any politician in America, Democrat or Republican, could run for office. So why was the poem not destroyed? Why did a set of intolerable ideas, an inquisitor's dream book of wicked ideas, make it through the centuries, and not only make it through the centuries, but inspire a succession of remarkable people, Botticelli, whose Primavera bears a direct relation to Lucretius, Montaigne, Bruno, the martyr of 1600, Galileo, and eventually people in our own world, including someone dear to, I think, dear to our hearts, namely Thomas Jefferson, who owned 5 copies of Lucretius's poem in Latin, and more importantly, who decided amazingly to put into the Declaration of Independence that this country should be founded for life, liberty, and what he called most strangely, the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness is a deep Epicurean idea, and we owe our world in very immediate and less immediate ways to the resurgence of these currents that happened one day when a little man took a book off a shelf in 600 years ago and set something in motion. With that, I'll stop and welcome your questions. Thank you very much.
So if you have a question, please raise your hand. We will get a mic to you. I can see we have some already. Gentleman in the yellow.
How do you know that this hero of yours was the only guy out there to resuscitate this Roman poet? How did you reach that conclusion? There must have been other things going. You know, this was something, the revival, the reinterest in the ancients was not just this one guy.
Of course not. No, of course not. The revival of the ancients was a culture-wide task that had been launched, they say, by Petrarch in the 15th century, who found Livy's history, who found Propertius's poems, who became famous in his lifetime for finding Cicero's private letters and so forth. I mean, so there's a huge task that had gone on for decades, and there are people, even before Petrarch, who had been, small numbers of people who had been interested, a whole group of people known as people interested in the study of the human, of the humanities, the humanists, in short, the Italian humanists. So Poggio is certainly not alone, and I didn't mean to suggest that. In fact, he's in a quite competitive relation to other humanists who are also ferreting around in libraries. And sometimes he goes on teams with them, 2 or 3 of them together to a library to see what they can find. Sometimes, as in this case, he goes alone. It happens that there was enough fame to be acquired in that world that the news traveled very quickly when you found something and you became famous for it. So Poggio was, in his lifetime, already famous for finding the whole of Quintilian's great work on rhetoric, for finding Vitruvius's book on architecture, for finding Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. So in other words, this is a contemporary reputation that no one denied. No one was saying, no, I found that damn thing. He found it. That was one of his claims to glory.
Another question, gentleman on our right.
Just have the one copy of Lucretius. Are there multiple original sources, and how reliable are our copies, is our knowledge of Lucretius?
Yes, at first, when it came back, it was the only copy, seemed to be the only copy that had made it. Somewhat more than a century later, though it wasn't announced, it becomes reasonably clear in retrospect from looking at a French scholar's edition of Lucretius, printed edition of Lucretius, that he must have seen another copy. And in the 17th century, that copy, and along with one other one, seemed to have surfaced, all from the 9th century. So probably in the end there were three copies that had made it through the monastic world and into the modern world. And in the 15th century, the first moment, and indeed for more than a century, the only copy that was known was the one that Poggio found. And in fact, the copy Poggio found has disappeared almost immediately. And the copy that Poggio had made by a scribe of that copy has also disappeared. So even that is several stages later. And for that very reason, and because any ancient book, by virtue of being copied over and over and over again, as in the telephone game that we played as children, it begins to change its message. So these books are all famously corrupted, as it were, changed over time. And that accounts for the industry of untold numbers of scholars who spent fantastic labor trying to reconstruct, trying to figure out what the original authors wrote. The general rule is that if a book was not copied in the 9th century under what they call the Carolingian Revival, it probably wouldn't make it from the ancient world. Anything that makes it through from the ancient world, except for a few carbonized fragments from Herculaneum, anything that made it from the ancient world made it because someone copied it in the 9th century. And they're always being copied. And those would have been 99.9% done by monks in scriptoria and monasteries. But the texts are unreliable, and we don't even know. I believe it's probably the whole of the poem, roughly as Lucretius planned it, but it may not be the whole one. Some people think it was broken off. Lucretius was thought to have committed suicide, maybe committed suicide before it was finished, or maybe he just died. Or maybe it was substantially complete. There's very little way of telling. There's an enormous scholarly industry that tries to speculate on it.
Did Poggio's joke book survive?
Poggio's joke book survived, that's true. Poggio was famous in his lifetime. The single most famous thing he wrote in his lifetime, though not the most respectable thing he wrote in his lifetime, was called the Facetiae. He wrote a Latin book of jokes that he said, and his fellow papal scribes used to tell each other when they were in the Vatican in what he called the bugiale, that is the lie factory. They sat around in the lie factory in the afternoons, and they told jokes, and the jokes are unbelievably dirty. And it became, and they actually are about people you wouldn't normally think you would tell dirty jokes about. Scabrous jokes about the sexual proclivities of monks and nuns and the Pope himself and anyone else that you can get your hands on, and also about their venality and so forth and so on. They're the usual set of jokes. Most of them aren't, the truth be told, very funny any longer, but they're kind of scandalous and interesting that way. And it's a sign of how peculiar, how distant we are in a way from the world of the ancient, or of the medieval, late medieval church, that that book circulated actually without much trouble for quite a long time, for at least a century. Then it was finally put on the index of prohibited books, and no one was allowed to read it in good faith as a Christian. But for almost a century, it circulated as a very popular joke book in the, how should we say, morally loose Italian world of the 15th century.
Another question right here in front.
Is there any secondary literature or letters about this, about the on the nature of things from that period?
From the ancient world.
Right.
From the ancient world, there's a fascinating letter by Cicero to his brother. Cicero didn't like Epicureanism and wouldn't have been the least bit sympathetic. Cicero said, not after all, not unimpressively, "This is the good news?" Cicero thought it was better to cling to an illusion. Cicero was a very sophisticated man, and he didn't believe in what he thought were the old wives' tales of the punishments in the afterlife. But he thought it was better for people, better for their behavior as citizens, better for their comfort as human beings, to think at least that there was a whole elaborate system of divine rewards and punishments in an afterlife. But he wrote, that said, he wrote a remarkable letter in which he says he's struck by what, after all, still strikes us, by the fact, something very odd in Lucretius, which is that he's simultaneously a tremendous poet, one of the truly great poets in the world, and at the same time a philosopher, an intellectual, a scientist. The conjunction of very high literary, specifically poetic skill, and very powerful scientific speculation struck Cicero as an oddity, and it strikes us as something of a miracle.
Lady right in the third row here.
Thank you so much. This has been great. Two things. This was in Latin.
Yes.
When did it get translated into other languages? And also, you refer to all these many, many things that have been lost. If there's were something that were to surface, what would you like to see surface?
Yeah. For things that were your first question about the translation is an extremely interesting question, because some of the survival of Lucretius depends on its amazing beauty as a Latin poem, but some of its survival depends also on the fact that it was of limited circulation, because you have to have not only Latin, but very good Latin. It's hard, at least I think it's hard. And it wasn't translated very quickly, partly because it's difficult, partly because the world that first was circulating was a world that had good Latin, so they didn't need translations of it, but eventually also because there were forces at work that were trying to keep it from getting translated. So there is, for example, there was an Italian translation done in the late 16th or early 17th century, I forget the exact date, but that the church kept out of print for a very, very long time. It was circulated in manuscript, but they wouldn't let it appear in print. There was a French translation that was done amazingly by Molière that's lost. It never got printed and it's disappeared. There was an English translation. The first English translation of the whole of Lucretius was not done until the 17th century, until the middle of the 17th century, the 1650s, there were some smaller sections of it that were done earlier. And that was done by a woman, remarkably enough, obviously a woman with very good Latin, a Puritan woman named Lucy Hutchinson, who wanted, in effect, to know intimately what the men were whispering about, because it was a subject for whispering, not for announcing it out loud. And when she did finally translate it, she said she hated it and hated all its ideas, but she didn't destroy her translation. She did the whole of it except for the sex parts, which she said was suitable for a midwife to translate, but not for herself. In any case, the translations came relatively late in the process, and probably for the reasons that I've explained. As for the things that, what would I like to turn up in the list of hits, I would love to read more plays by Sophocles and Aeschylus, first and foremost, probably. Amazing that there were so many more that we've lost. I would love to see in Latin, the most famous poet, ancient poet in the Latin world was Ennius, E-N-N-I-U-S. Nothing made sense. They all quote him. They're little lines here and there, and everyone refers to Ennius as the great poet, the equivalent of Homer for the Latin language, but he's gone. He didn't survive. So I'd take Ennius.
A few more questions. Gentleman here in the third row.
What could possibly have prompted Pope John the 23rd of our time to have taken on the moniker of Pope John the 23rd, his predecessor. I know was an iconoclast, but there must be some other rationale for doing that.
My guess is he thought that the name Giovanni was a good name, and it was a pity that it had been out of circulation for so long. And everything we know about Roncalli suggests he was a man with remarkably little fear of what people would think, so that he had hardly made a reputation for himself remarkably during the very dark days of the Second World War, saving the lives of Jews when he was already, I think, was an archbishop or even a cardinal. That was not typical behavior. So very, very unusual character. And my guess is he thought the name John was a beautiful name and that enough time had passed. Also, maybe, if you know Italians, they're very true to their to the place they're from. Italians don't think of themselves as Italian. They think of themselves as Genovese and Fiorentini and so forth. He was a Neapolitan, like Bartolomeo Cossa. Maybe he thought that he would bring that name back also in some relation to where his disgraced predecessor had been from and undo the damage that his predecessor was, in fact, a very wicked fellow. So he did undo a lot of that damage.
Right here in the front row.
Did Lucretius address the question of those atoms, what their origin was or where they came from?
Only in the sense that he thought they had no origins and didn't come from anywhere. He thought that they were there forever. That the forms, he had the opposite view of what, let's say, Aristotle thought, or Plato, even better. Plato thought that the forms of things were eternal, but that the matter was temporary. Lucretius thought that the matter was eternal and the forms were temporary. It's just the reverse of that account of the universe.
Gentleman about six rows back in the blue or black.
Would you recommend an English translation?
It's a very hard question to answer. There isn't a single great English translation in poetry of Lucretius' wonderful poem. There are many translations in prose. I happen to like, because I encountered it as a young man when I first stumbled on the poem, a translation by a British classicist named Martin Ferguson Smith that's still available and that I think is very, very good. But there are many translations. There's an old one by Munro. There are some very recent ones. And then there are some poetic translations, none of which has given me complete pleasure. The best poetic translation, in my view, is not of the whole poem, but John Dryden, the great 17th century English poet and something of a libertine, translated something like, I can't, maybe 600 or 700 lines of Lucretius's greatest hits. And though Dryden's poetry, because it was written a long time ago, is also rather difficult for us, the translation is beautiful, really beautiful. Dryden really got it. So if you want to hear a little bit, in my view, of what the delicious flavor of Lucretius's poetry would have been like in English, I would suggest that you look at Dryden. Or, as they say, there are many, very interesting translations, that one that Oxford University Press publishes by, I want to say, Ronald Melville, one that Penguin translates by Stallings, each of which are interesting, but none of which quite get it, in my view. But it's hard to get. I tried to persuade, I have a friend, Robert Pinsky, who I think did a wonderful translation of Dante, of the Inferno, and I tried to persuade him to translated, but he said, no. To translate 7,400 lines of complex Latin hexameters, a lot of which is about physics, is no small undertaking.
Lady about seven rows back here on our left.
Thank you. I'm trying to imagine how the ideas in that poem became current in the 15th century. How did the ideas circulate? How did they exert their influence that you describe as you know, causing a revolution, an intellectual revolution. How did that actually happen in a time before books and when many people were illiterate?
They certainly didn't become current in any of our senses of current. And in general, what you have to think of is the butterfly that trembles its wings in Thailand and somehow eventually causes a cyclone in the Caribbean. So there's a very long and complicated and indirect route that leads from the recovery of this text to the things that actually now pop out at us when we read this text, namely Darwin, Einstein, Freud, Marx. But in the 15th century, copies started to be made, the old game of copying again, manuscript copies, and they began to circulate among those people who cared about the poem. The greatest philosopher of the 15th century in Italy was Florentine named Marsilio Ficino. Ficino was a young man, was almost the only person probably in his time who really got what was at stake here, and he started to write a commentary on Lucretius, and then he burned it. And his burning it is a sign of the fact that he saw where this was taking him, and he didn't want to go there. Another person in the late 15th century copied the whole thing, 7,400 lines of this poem in Latin, didn't sign his name to it, never mentioned that he had read this work, but he was identified only in the 20th century from the manuscript which survives in the Vatican as the copy that Machiavelli made. So there are signs of circulation, as it were, under the radar. Once it gets into print, it's much harder to control. It's harder to stop. Print is a very dangerous medium, as people discovered in various parts of life, to their horror. And once it made it into print, you can see it's much more rapid transmission. But the survival through that long period of intolerability is the result of two unlikely, I think, unlikely heroes. The first is scholarship, classical scholarship. People came along who did the thing to Lucretius that they did to any classical text. They wrote elaborate philological commentaries trying to figure out what the words meant and so on and so on. They didn't necessarily give a damn about what it said. They just began to do what academics do when they get hold of a text and sort of gnaw it to death. So they began to produce these enormous printed commentaries, which had a single line of Lucretius and then 400 lines of commentary. That is one way in which you could keep the thing going at a time in which it might have been so intolerable it could be destroyed. And the second, in a way more interesting form of transmission, is the one I've alluded to already. You get amazing people like Botticelli getting in a different way, not saying, I believe the world is made up out of atoms and emptiness and nothing else, and the soul dies after at the same time that the body dies, but painting the Primavera, which, as I say, is very closely based on Lucretius. Or you get Montaigne, who quotes Lucretius more than 100 times in his work, and more than quotes Lucretius, who has the spirit of Lucretius deeply in his essays. And then eventually you get the scientists, Galileo, Newton, who take it from a different direction what's going on here and put it on a different basis and make it basically unstoppable. But the early centuries are touch and go and under the radar.
We'll have to leave it under the radar. Please join me in thanking Stephen Greenblatt.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.